Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 245 for June 6th. Jeep Renegade gets ready to invade the world. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Auto Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Hello, Gary.
John, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good.
And we got to let everybody know we got Todd Lassa back again with Automobile Magazine.
Yes, with Automobile Magazine, yes.
Yeah, hey, boy, John. You guys went through some changes, didn't you?
Yeah, afraid so, yeah. But, you know.
Well, we talked all about that last week.
Okay.
And there's a lot. Maybe we'll get into it again. We'll see where this all goes.
Probably a good idea.
But the big bombshell today, the GM investigation, and I know you guys have been following this. Todd, you were actually at the press conference.
I was at the press conference, yes, and at the at Barra's town meeting, you know, we were able to watch remotely, where she gave her comments to, 220,000 employees watching around the world. And, you know, minus 15, of course, because
they fired 15.
50 to 60% executive level or north of
including
that.
Including one VP, right? Didn't she say that?
She did mention a VP, but she wouldn't identify the 15. I saw that Bloomberg identified a lawyer who, according to the report, which I did not get to see because by the time I got the link to it, I wasn't able to download it.
I'm sure Gary has the report and has read it cover to cover.
Gary's the guy who does that.
I've read most of the report. Yes, indeed, John. The Anton Valukas report, the lawyers.
327 pages.
Yeah, and there's a large section that's redacted that deals with actual accidents.
So now, when Gary means redacted, what he means is there's literally like somebody took a big black marker. And it's like the CIA and taking
the NSA stuff going on here. No, but that part of the report, I mean, it's not all that essential for people to know. And I think that if you read the first 100 pages of the report, and they do a great job. I mean, even though it's a bunch of lawyers wrote this thing, I mean, it is easy to follow, and I think it is absolutely devastating. And it's a description. I mean, the focus on the 15 people who have lost their jobs, I think that that's not the story at all. I think the story is, and Barra indicated this in her remarks, that this is basically a systemic problem that General Motors had.
For sure.
That this is fundamentally an issue that is organizational. And there are two brilliant little spots in this report that comes out. One is an engineer described it as being the GM salute. And what the GM salute is that you stand there, you cross your arms, and you point at the other guys. Okay, so this is not your problem. The other is the GM nod, which means you are in a meeting and you nod your head in agreement, then you leave the meeting and do nothing.
Uh-huh.
And this is, you know, so
clearly happened a lot in this case.
Right. And, you know, it's just crazy that
But here's my question. I've been asking this all along.
Excuse me.
GM initiated hundreds of other recalls during the same time frame. So why did this one fall through the cracks? Did others fall through the cracks? You know, if this is a systemic, endemic, you know, problem at GM, how come it did all these other recalls?
I asked a question at the press conference about whether there was anything in the report to indicate there was a cover-up, and Mark Royce answered. And the reason I asked is that we still hadn't seen the report by the time the press conference started.
That's right.
And he said that, and he referred directly to the report. He said the report shows no indication of a cover-up. And that was actually kind of a follow-up question to one about this specific case. You know, one of the big hang-ups was why did General Motors change the part without changing the part number? very big question that has still kind of looms over this whole
thing. We still don't have that answer.
Well, I asked whether the Veloukis report looked into any other similar design changes, and this may be a little bit of a problem with the report in that it didn't. So do we know, has General Motors done this before? Have they done it before or after the ignition switch? No, it was studied more or less in isolation. Now, all that other cultural stuff came out, but we have that specific defect studied in isolation.
Well, in the report, actually, Barra is quoted in the report, and they ask her about the part number. So for the people who are not inside baseball in this thing, I think we ought to explain to them what's going on.
Yeah.
So basically, the ignition switch was designed and signed off on, and the ignition switch didn't do its job. So there were parameters set in terms of how much force, how much torque would be required to get it into a detent and whether it would stay in a detent or not. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is said in the report is that the parameters were not met, yet they went ahead with approving the part. Okay, so this is part of the reason why there was a problem, because then for, I think, 2008, when they were launching another vehicle, they actually did put an additional longer spring in, which they hadn't thought they'd been able to do with the first one. Okay, they put another spring in, and they kept the same part number. Okay, so they were looking at it from the point of view of, well, gee whiz, there's no problem because look, these new cars are on. There's not a problem at all. So you know, what's the issue? So it didn't seem like a cover. It reminded me of a gang.
No. But the question has always been: so whenever you make a change to a part like that,
right,
typical according to GM protocol, the part number should have changed with it, so that they
right.
can say, well, this is the part we had with the better spring post 2008.
Sure, it's a different part. I mean, but
and they didn't change the part number,
right?
So
but,
that's
Barra says, you know, that's engineering 101. So this isn't just a GM procedure. This is a procedure for any engineer working at any company that, you know, you change something, it's got a different number.
So again, why didn't they change the part number when they changed the part, and why, you know, If they had studied more of these recalls or part changes, would they have found consistently that this was the only part that perhaps has ever happened to?
Well, there's in the study, and this is sort of interesting too, and it's related to that. Okay, so apparently there was a problem that people had with their Saturn Ions, and that was one of the cars that was involved on the Delta platform, that. They were having a problem cold start. Okay, the cars wouldn't start in the cold. Mm-hmm. Okay, they returned the ignition and the ignition wasn't working, right? And so the ion was being built Spring Hill. So they're down in Spring Hill and they're testing this. And there's no problem. Okay,
people not that cold.
People are taking their cars to the dealer, right? The dealer gets it in the shop, right? It's sitting there, warms up, no problem. So this was identified. I mean, this was a problem that people were complaining about. So what they discovered was after taking a refrigerated truck down to Spring Hill and putting a car in and soaking it, discovered that the grease was being, you know, was not performing as it should.
Because they had no Saturn Ions in Michigan they could have tested?
Well,
I mean, they had
well,
they're doing the testing. Truck down there?
Well, so after they did that and they changed the grease, they changed the part number.
Uh-huh.
But it was still the faulty ignition switch. But again, I mean, it comes down to this thing of it's like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. I mean, and so
that's part of it. But a couple of points here, just before we get off this topic of a cover up. My understanding, based on people I've talked to in the industry, is one individual cannot sneak through a design change without changing the part number. What I've been told is multiple people had to know of this. The supplier had to know. Purchasing had to know. Blah, 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 all the way down the line. The second thing, which is where I also have a problem that there was allegedly no cover-up, is in litigation, lawsuits against GM on this very thing, when lawyers ask for what they call a quote-unquote scope of interest, where they want all kinds of documents related to this. I mean, it's been proved. It came out in the congressional hearings. General Motors' legal department did not distribute those documents. I mean, in my definition, that's a cover-up. I think we need more clarification on both these points. How does a design change get through the system without a part number change? And what about this legal thing? To me, that smells of a cover-up.
Well, okay, and this speaks to that somewhat, but not entirely. And this gets to the point of, okay, there are a bunch of other recalls that happened. I mean, in the report, it says something like 274 recalls a year is on an average basis sort of thing. But the problem was defined as the moving stall. So this was the issue that, you know, that somebody would accidentally hit the ignition switch with their knee or something, and the car would stall. When the car would stall, the airbags would be, you know, shut off. The airbags would be deactivated. The engineers did not know that that was a causal factor, okay? And according to the report, this is a quote, the engineers made a basic mistake. They did not know how their own vehicle had been designed, close quote, okay? So they didn't see that. So here are the guys who are running this program, and they defined this problem of the moving stall as being a problem of convenience, not of safety. If it had been identified as a safety problem, then it would have taken a whole nother level of scrutiny. But because it was a problem that, well, you know, people can get this fixed, they go to the dealer and...
It came up this morning. It's that basically the way I understand it, the way that Mary Barra described it, is that it was seen as a problem of the engine shutting off and you lose power steering. Now, is that a safety defect? A lot of people would say yes. I've driven...
I'd say yes.
Most cars in my life without power steering, and I've also driven cars that where the engine has shut off and I've lost power steering, and you know, it hasn't been an issue, but I could see how it would be an issue. Now, they apparently at the time, the GM engineers did not see that as an issue. They saw it, as you point out, as a matter of convenience. So now what you have is at least 13 deaths associated with the defect, but all those deaths apparently are attributed to the airbags not going off. Now questions coming up about other people in the car, people in the back seat where you didn't have airbags in those cars back then. And also, you know, if by law, if you're not wearing your seatbelt, or not by law, but by design, the airbag is not supposed to go off if you're not wearing your seatbelt, right? So
I don't think that's true.
No.
Remember, seatbelts are officially referred to as, you know, or airbags are supplemental.
Yeah.
But they will go off if you're not wearing your bag.
So anyway, let's say you've got someone in the back seat who is a fatality as a result of one of these crashes.
It was not.
Rather than the airbag doesn't go off because it's a side impact or a rear impact or something else that doesn't require the airbags to deploy. Will those potential deaths be counted in addition?
Sure, they will. In a court of law, of course, they're going.
Well, it's up to Kenneth Feinberg. First of all, that's one thing that came out today. Secondly, then the question is, was it a safety defect? Then you'd have to say, well, yes, it actually was a safety defect that perhaps the power steering went out, and that's why the car was in the accident. That's the causal portion of that, not the question of whether or not the airbags went off.
Right, but again, it's you know, again for the audience, the Ken Feinberg, he's the guy who did the payouts for the BP oil spill. He's the guy who did the payouts for the 9/11 Boston bombing,
right.
So on. He's an attorney, and so he's going to make a determination of what General Motors is going to be paying people who have claims that are related to this whole thing, and you know that's. I don't know how that guy can do. He must have the world's biggest heart. And
well, and basically,
it's thickest skin. Because I just can't imagine.
Basically, it's
that
up.
Job.
It's up to him. You know, the question came up several times: were there more than 13 deaths? What's the number? What's your official number? And GM says today its official number is 13, and it does not have the authority under this deal with the Feinberg to change that number. It's all up to Feinberg. It's not up to NHTSA. It's not up to General Motors.
Right.
Well, the number is going to be bigger, sure.
But this is the thing, and this is also a report, and I think and this is what General Motors needs to really come to grips with and address. And it says, quote, here as elsewhere in the story, the cobalt, and this is just sort of summing up what had been going on over years because they break it down into sections. Elsewhere in the story, the structure within GM was one in which no one was held responsible and no one took responsibility. And I mean, and that is fundamentally what is at the basis of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So going forward, how does that change? How does that organization change whereby people take responsibility? Because Barra did point out today that one of the problems was that some of the people who did lose their jobs were people who basically it was not the sin of commission, it was the sin of omission.
Well, number one, she identified some of them as just plain incompetent.
Right.
Yep. And others for failing to take action.
Exactly.
But, yeah. You know, I keep coming back to this point. We're talking about one out of, you said, 297 recalls a year over a 10-year period. I mean, they initiated hundreds of recalls. This one fell through the crack. Mm-hmm. You know, it's also interesting that NHTSA has a lot of culpability. NHTSA had all the data. But what turns out now, and I think this is where the GM guys went down the wrong path, NHTSA got info that, the airbags are not deploying. And so they did exhaustive studies as to why the airbag was not deploying. But what did they look at? They looked at the sensors. They looked at the wiring. They looked at the propellant. They looked at the airbag packing. They looked at everything. No one said, hey, wait a minute, could something else be causing this? They never even thought of that.
And it's worth pointing out to that point that when you test cars like that, or when someone brings a car into the dealership and said, hey, this keeps stalling on me while I'm driving it, what do you do with the keys? Do you hand them your whole set of keys? You don't. And if NHTSA brings in some cars for testing, does the guy from NHTSA put all of his house keys on the keychain? No, there's a very fundamental flaw just in the testing. I mean, how do you determine what apparently is the most common way for this problem to occur, and that's to have too heavy a keychain on that poorly designed cheap ignition switch?
They did look at the whole key thing. And this, I think, is, this is a cultural problem. This is an organizational problem. This is a whole big issue. So basically, if you looked at the original Ion key, there was an arc. Okay, it was a slotted arc.
Elongated,
right? And so then, engineers cleverly came up with the idea that if we just have a hole punched through it
in the middle,
just one round hole, this will prevent things on the keychain from moving up and down, because if you have the slot, right, things can move up and down. And if you have a heavy keychain, you know, that's going to put more force that's going to deactivate the ignition. If you have the one hole, you'll be good to go. Okay? So they've got this all worked out. They've got drawings, so on and so forth. So they did a study. But again, remember, this was considered to be a matter of inconvenience, not a matter of safety. So they have the General Motors product problem resolution tracking system, okay? So they looked at the key, you know, changing the head of the key, and determined that the lead time would be too long, the tooling cost and piece price would be too high, and no solution would be a full countermeasure. So the bottom line was, quote, none of the solutions represents an acceptable business case,
right.
Close quote.
Right.
Okay.
That was a Lori Queen quote, I believe.
So an acceptable business. And apparently that is the term that was just, you know, if that ever came up, it's.
But just for clarification, too, the one hole was not just to prevent the keys from bouncing up and down in that slot. But, you know, if you think of the access of the key and the head of the key, if you have a hole right in the center of that end of the key, there isn't leverage for whatever dangling from it. So in other words, if you have this elongated slot, it's like having, you know, a lever arm that can apply more torque on the key. With the hole in the center, you don't apply, theoretically, you don't apply any torque.
Right.
Well, I wish I had my keychain with you, and I'd show you all the crap that I have on my keychain, and I've never had a problem. So I think it gets back to this badly designed switch, and that's what it all comes down to.
But going back to your question, Gary, is does this change anything in GM? And here's my fear. They're making all kinds. Okay, they fired 15 people. They disciplined 15. They're doing all these. They hired a new head of safety. He reports to Mark Royce. He then talks with Mary. The board is updated. But all I'm afraid of is here's this monstrously, bureaucratic organization. What are they doing? They're adding on more layers of bureaucracy. I think what they need to do is incentivize people the right way and drive the decision-making down as far as they can. They don't need more and more people looking over everyone's shoulder. They need right decisions being made at the point where the decision's being made.
They do have in their presentation today a plan, a program to reward employees for coming forth with this.
Now, but how coming well forth gonna, is not what I'm getting at. I'm saying, like, I'm the engineer, and it's like, hey, this isn't working.
Yeah.
We're going to get this thing right. I'm going to make the decision. I'm going to go bang tables. I'm going to get the budget, which I think originally, early on, they were talking like pennies to fix this thing. Mm-hmm. So that's where the decision-making has got to be down at the level of the people who can instantly fix it.
Right, but they have to take ownership, responsibility for that. And I think to Todd's point that if you reward people, they'd be more likely to want to do that.
Well, and sometimes it's just as simple as explaining to people, here's what your responsibility is. Here are resources that you can get. Instead of saying, you got to go to committee 419/B and, report this, and then they're going to take it to a group that goes on and on and on. This is a 100-year-old plus company. They have got processes for everything. And process is good, but sometimes when it comes down to making right decisions, you don't want people looking over the shoulder and looking over the shoulder and looking over the shoulder. It just slows everything down.
And to that point, 3 points. One is, what is your whistleblower policy? Because whistleblowers tend to get treated very poorly when they blow the whistle on problems like this. Do you have a process by which a low-level employee can complain and say, my boss said, don't worry about that. It's going to cost too much. This part will work. Do you have a process by which that person can go a level higher and keep going levels up until he or she's talking to Mary Barra and saying, hey, look, this is going to happen again? Secondly, it's just to your point, it's the density of the General Motors bureaucracy. We know they've got 220,000 employees. I don't know exactly what the breakout is between blue collar and white collar, but that white collar part of the company is so kind of dense that, it does seem possible that you could have a problem like this that gets kicked upward and gets kicked downward, but doesn't go to the very top levels of the company.
And this is why I keep coming back to the same issue again. This is the one thing that fell through the crack.
Yeah.
If this was a systemic endemic problem at GM, it should have problems all over the place.
Yeah.
And they've had hundreds of recalls. Guess what? So has every other company.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. I got to make a recall on my statement about recalls. So I got to take ownership here. I found the exact number here. I was completely wildly wrong. I'm like, this is okay. From January 1st, 2000 through December 31st, 2013, GM issued 374 recalls, an average of 26 recalls a year with a total of 50.1 million vehicles affected, an average of 3.6 million vehicles per year.
Okay.
So,
nonetheless,
I was wrong.
Hundreds of recalls happen.
I should be rewarded.
Here's one that,
you should be rewarded.
You stood up to it.
Sure.
Of course, we would have blown the whistle on you at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
Even without being incentivized to do so. But hey, look, do we have burning issues to get to this? Because there's some other topics we got to get.
I just want to make one more
you
point.
You got the last
one. I spoke about this at automobilemag.com, a column I wrote today after the press conference. And I'm still puzzled by the fact that this happened so many years after Nader. And I wonder if that's part of the cultural problem with General Motors, that it had really botched the Nader thing. I mean, I'm not, questions aside about the Corvair, the way General Motors had Nader followed and spied upon and so on. And so afterward, did they learn from that and say, look, we're going to turn around, we're going to be diligent about safety? It appears, you know, going forward another 45 years or so, that no, maybe they retrenched even more and said, you know, we're going to hunker down and you know, try to keep this away. And so that's the cultural change that I hope Mary Barra is making.
Yeah. By the way, I thought Mary did a pretty good job.
Yeah, she did great.
She didn't come across as Mary, quite contrary as she did in the congressional hearings. I thought she came across as a CEO in charge.
Well, and now she's got things to quote. I mean, unfortunately, the timing on that thing, that first congressional hearing, was so early that, you know, any lawyer would tell you just to shut up and not say anything, and that's what she was stuck with.
Yeah. Hey, let's jump topics completely, because all three of us were in Santa Barbara earlier this week. Just
I've spent way too much time. Well, I've spent more time with Gary this week than with my wife.
driving. Let's be clear about this.
And now here today.
Let's talk about the driving.
We drove together, sat on airplanes together.
That's right.
We were driving the Lincoln MKC.
Yeah.
You know, Lincoln's new small crossover competing against, what, Audi Q5, BMW X3.
Acura RDX.
Acura RDX, Mercedes GLK, just to give the audience a sense of where. And I'm sure most of the audience is somewhat familiar. You know, it's been at car shows now. But so reactions, Todd? What?
Well, I was pleasantly surprised. I thought it was better than it turned out to be better than I thought it would be. It didn't make me think Ford Escape Titanium really at all. I mean, the interior is nicely done. The sheet metal is completely different. It's kind of like, you know, MKT versus Ford Flex, for example. But
bad example.
MKC. I like those better than the Explorer, which is my least favorite Ford,
right.
You know, by far. But you know, it handled well, and yet it had a supple enough ride, sufficiently supple for that category, at least on the relatively smooth California roads we had. And we only drove the top spec model, which I have to say, at $50,000 all in, fully loaded. You know, I think it makes a better Acura RDX competitor than it does a Mercedes GLK or BMW X3 competitor. But the new 2.3-liter EcoBoost 4, 285 horsepower and 305 pound-feet of
torque,
that's the same engine that will go in the Mustang, which is several hundred pounds lighter than this vehicle. And that bodes well for that Mustang EcoBoost.
Mm-hmm. Gary, what do you think of the MKC?
Yeah, I would agree largely with what Todd says about how this seems to be a real execution by Lincoln, more so than the MKZ, mm-hmm. the sedan,
compared to the Fusion,
right? I mean, it's you know, as Todd said, it's completely different car from the outside and on the inside, and even the suspension in the up trim that we drove it is different, and I don't think mechanically it's all that much different.
No.
You know, there's settings and bushings and so on, but you know, you were saying that it makes a better competitor for an RDX than for a GLK or an X3. The question is whether people will willingly part with $50,000 to buy
Lincoln.
A small. Because remember, this is a C-class small crossover vehicle, not a large crossover vehicle. And in that class of the cars we mentioned, I mean, RDX is the leader of the pack. I mean, it's got the greatest number of sales. Interestingly enough, its sales are not so good this month. But it's that becomes a big question. But I'll bet, you know. And the other thing was that we were told at the presentation about how this is a vehicle that they think will do great guns for them in China. And then we've talked about on the show before about how they have a China strategy, and that market is key for the success of the Lincoln Motor Company. And I suspect that there is probably half an eye on the U.S. market and an eye and a half on
the Chinese
market.
Yeah.
And as you know, I mean, that's a pretty easy thing to do, because the Chinese market is closer, the mindset is closer to ours than Europe is to
sure.
ours. And so, you know, and I, I agree. And by the way, the wheelbase is the same as the Ford Escape. They've widened the front and rear track by
the track.
I think it's 0.9 inches.
I want to say 22 millimeters wider than the Escape.
So they've made a few changes.
I like the vehicle. I too was pleasantly surprised. I was actually knocked out at how good that 2.3 turbo is. Mm-hmm. I mean, no turbo lag at all.
Nice tip-in, yeah.
Nice tip-in. Even at highway speeds, boom, the thing was right there. Yeah. I mean, 305 foot-pounds of torque out of a 2.3-liter engine. To me, that was very impressive.
Yeah.
Even more impressively, too, was no real buzziness, no real whine. I think part of that is active noise cancellation and all the other stuff that they've got hooked onto the engine. And the thicker glass up front is good at isolating things. The one thing I did notice, the one criticism I'll have of the car, which they can fix, was some of the fit and finish on some of the cars was, hey, better not benchmark those things against Audi in the showroom. Now, what they told us is these were not saleable units. I think there's one iteration yet that will be the saleable unit. But some of the hood fit, some of the door fit was... Some of the cars were brilliant. I mean, they were really good. Some of the others needed some work.
Well, even the car they had on display the night before we drove it, they're very proud of that wraparound rear
the hydroform lift hatch.
Hydroform,
which is a whole other discussion.
But the parting lines on the side were a little suspect, I think, on that.
You know, it was sensitive to the angle that you're looking at.
That's true.
As you walked around, you'd say, ooh, that doesn't look so good, but it's very wavy, concavey, curvy. And as I walked around, from some angle, something that didn't look lined up, from another angle, looked just fine. And that's part of the problem when you have these long, windy, sinuous cut lines.
But, you know, you were mentioning that, you know, they told us that these cars were not the fully baked vehicles. But Ford reported selling 677 of them in the month of May.
Yeah. Why didn't they give us a few of those?
Now.
Well, you know
how it is. Typically, media test fleet vehicles are some of the first ones built because they got to get them in the media's hands so they we can all start writing stories, reporting on it. And so we typically get earlier versions. So now we're going to have to go to the showrooms and look. And by the way, everybody, if you here's a sure giveaway. The right-hand side of the hood gap tends to be much smaller than the left-hand side gap. So if you're looking at hoods, there's the first giveaway that I noticed. They have more issues with the hoods lining up properly than they do with the doors. Hmm. So if you want a quick glance at an MKC, go check the hood alignment. If it's good, chances are the rest of the vehicle's fine.
It is. And I mentioned there's one feature that Todd and I disagreed. Todd and I drove together, so this is one.
That
he and I...
More of you than his wife.
Yeah.
We were like Oscar and Felix.
Yes, but so the MKC, like other Ford products and other products from other manufacturers, has the self-parking feature, which the new one is really quite interesting. And what is even more interesting is that it has the park out feature. So if you parallel park your car, and let's say you do it yourself, because Todd believes that people should parallel park themselves. They should not be given a license, and they should probably be banned from.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, I like people who can parallel park well. I like when I'm sitting at an outdoor cafe watching people who can't parallel park. It's a matter of great amusement to
me. It is.
But I think my problem with it is it's a little bit of, it's the Martin Swig, the beginning of the end of Western civilization was the event of the disc brake. And I like blind spot and cross traffic warnings are all very well and good, especially on a big sport utility where you can't always see real well. But I think it's also kind of dumbing down the driver, and I wonder how many young drivers soon won't even bother to look behind them, no matter what the little sign on the dashboard says, because they've got blind spot and cross traffic and all kinds of warnings.
Hey, it's happening to me already.
So the parallel parking snob notwithstanding, but what is very interesting is this park out feature that basically, okay, so let's say Todd parks his car parallel parks it, and it's all good, and he's got space in front of him, behind him. And then the people who were parked in front of him, behind him, leave, and two jackasses come and basically
hem him in.
The system, so we're told, will get you out of that spot. It'll keep, you know, uses all ultrasonic
sensors. It'll only take 37 minutes.
It may take 37 minutes, but, you know, if there were someone that wasn't Todd behind the wheel, like me, I may just have to abandon my car and, you know,
but
something else.
But again, the argument is that if you did do that yourself and you had a car without power steering, you wouldn't have to go to the gym.
That's true.
You know.
Okay. Enough of this discussion. We've got a Jeep Renegade in the studio here with us. We also have the vehicle line executive with that. So let's cut this out. Let's take a break. Let's get him on. Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
Okay, here we go.
So we've got Phil Jansen in the studio right now, and he's brought his Jeep Renegade along with him. And Phil, thanks so much for coming in and joining us for the show.
Well, thank you, John and Gary and Todd. We're really pleased to bring the Jeep Renegade here. It's obviously our entry into the small SUV segment for Jeep globally. So we're pretty excited about it. And
you know what's amazing is you see them out and about, and they look pretty small. Here in the studio, it doesn't look all that small.
It's about proportions. If you look at the vehicle and get inside the vehicle, it's intended to feel like a good mid-sized Jeep. But again, as we position our Jeeps across a segment, this segment alone globally is about a 2 million the size segment, and it's going to grow.
Wow.
So we want to re-enter this segment with Jeep and really appeal to also a younger customer.
So, Phil, who do you see in that segment? Who is this going up against?
It's interesting.
What is it going up against?
Yeah, and from a size-wise and a volume-wise, and, you know, you could say the Juke, the Soul, the Countryman. In Europe, it could be the Yeti. But, you know, from a Jeep perspective, they don't offer the capability that we're going to offer. So, you know, we have direct competitors from a positioning and size-wise, but also, obviously, we have to deliver best-in-class capability, mm-hmm. and that's what we intend to do.
So just so the audience knows, run through very, very briefly, roughly the size, the powertrain, the price, just so they get an idea where this is. You mentioned some competitors, but so that they know specific to this vehicle.
Yeah. So just overall size, again, we call it a B segment, so it's about 4.3 meters in terms of overall length. Engines are four cylinders. We have basically our 1.4 multi-air fire engine, and we have our 2.4 Tiger Shark engine, multi-air, matched up with various transmission. I'll talk about that shortly. But in terms of, I can't tell you about price. We haven't announced pricing yet.
Dang it.
but we'll be competitive, but I can't give you any figures. And overall, in this segment, in terms of what people are looking for, is really that flexibility of interior space. It's a five-passenger vehicle. But I'll explain some of the capability that we offer in it, too, and we go around the vehicle.
And now, for the U.S. market, this version will be built in Italy, right?
That is correct.
And then you're putting a plant in Brazil as well, is that right?
Yeah, as we made public statements, we're growing our Jeep global footprint.
And China.
And we're growing our Jeep global footprint.
So that tells me three plants building this thing. And I know you haven't announced the size of the plants or the like, but that suggests to me it could be like almost 600,000 vehicles?
Well, I'm not going to give you any numbers, but as I said, the segment is big. The segment's big in China. The segment's big in Europe, in Latin America, and it's growing here in the United States. So we're positioning ourselves in Jeep to really leverage what, you know, Jeep's always been a global brand. It's one of the few brands that left free samples around the world when it started. You know, so, you know, we've
a good way to put it.
We've had a kind of a really small global footprint for a long time. And now that we've really been developing the brand and introducing our new products, as Mike Manley made very clearly on the Investor Day, our plan is now to really grow the Jeep. It's got a worldwide recognition and put it in the markets that really want it. And this vehicle here is really a prime position for that because the segment it's competing in.
Phil, was this vehicle developed in the U.S.?
Well, our Jeeps, you know, as I said, they're global vehicles.
Sure.
And this is really a global development team.
Okay.
So it was one of those programs we basically started to leverage the Fiat Chrysler size. So we leveraged our European team and our North American team. We did a lot of the styling design in our Jeep studios. You're with Mark Allen and Klaus Busse. You know, they know Jeeps, and that's where it started, the concept. We worked globally with our architecture team here and there to set up the basic fundamentals of the vehicle in terms of what it had to do. Did a lot of driveline development here, working with our colleagues. And then we set all their objectives, because the core of who knew what Jeep had to be was the start here. But meantime, we started then on our global team bringing over our colleagues from Europe and really experiencing them to Jeep, and because they had to go back and really industrialize it in market, because you really want your engineering focus close to the production site.
Mm-hmm.
So our European team, and Fabio DeMiro leads up our European team over there on this project, we've worked closely together where they do a lot of the design development, kind of the detailed execution of the functions that we've set up. We do a lot of the validation testing. They do validation testing. So we're trying to make sure, as a global vehicle, that we leverage our capabilities.
Is this the first time that you've had a program like this within Jeep?
It's a first of this global development scope. Grand Cherokee is an example that I spent almost 6 years on. We kind of co-developed that with Daimler, but we did modules with them. Okay, we did the main vehicle. We did like some suspension modules or some seat modules, but not really the full global size. Obviously, Cherokee, we leveraged the architecture out of Europe and then brought that over and took it over and developed the Cherokee really here in North America. So on this one, we sort of spread the responsibility across the globe and leveraged our capabilities, because as we develop a global footprint of Jeep, we got to have global capability.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things we actually did is brought the team over and they took off-roading, kind of really got them around. They've actually surrounded themselves over there with really a lot of what Jeep is, so they could get the feeling of it as they design all the components.
Mm-hmm. Phil, do you expect Europe to be the biggest market for this model?
It's economically dependent. I mean, Europe is a really strong B-segment market, but it all depends on what the markets do. I mean, I don't know where China's going to end up going on this. And
sure. But either of those probably more so than North America.
It's the B segment market in North America is growing.
Yeah.
It's not huge today, but it is one that's continuing to grow.
Now, so remember, you're saying North America. That includes Mexico. And I would believe B segment vehicles like this would do well there.
I refer to the whole market.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
If you sold a lot of them here, if it took off along with the B segment, would you consider North American production, NAFTA production for it?
Well, we're always keeping our options flexible. But, you know, again, we have Jeep facilities. The intent, as Mike explained, was to really get a global footprint and the flexibility of that global footprint.
Now, let me ask, Sergio Marchionne has talked about how Fiat Chrysler's two international brands are Alfa Romeo and Jeep. Now, for Alfa Romeo, he says he doesn't want any Alfa Romeos built outside of Italy. Do you fear any kind of backlash toward the brand by building it outside of NAFTA? I know you used to build Jeeps in Beijing.
I'll say no, but here's why I'll say no.
Yeah.
We've built Jeeps in Egypt. We build Jeeps in Venezuela.
Now?
We have historically.
Forever.
For a long time. We had them
used
built
to
in
do
Beijing.
Them in China?
We were the first one in Beijing for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sort of feeling that Jeeps were always built here in Toledo and in Detroit. But no, Jeeps have been built globally for a long time.
The only difference being that those vehicles were sold in those markets. I think maybe Todd's question, would there be an American backlash to a non-American made Jeep? I doubt it.
It's subjective.
You know, this goes back to the original when Honda first came to America. Would people buy American-made Hondas? Yeah, without a problem.
But I think the difference is that people who buy Hondas are probably not as passionate as people who buy Jeeps. I mean, you've got a whole cadre of people who really.
And the same is true for Alfa Romeo on the Jeep side, not the Honda side. And so Mark Ioanna was very adamant about this, that at some point in the last couple of years they decided, as you know, the Miata-based sports car will be a Fiat now instead of an Alfa Romeo, and in part that fits in, whether that's the reason or not, that fits in with his plan to make all Alfa Romeos or keep them all Italian production. So...
So let's come at this from a different way. Let's say this was built on the moon, okay? Okay, what makes the Renegade a Jeep? And if you're a Jeep person, you'd say, damn it, it's a Jeep. Yeah.
So, and by the way, physics is the same everywhere. Okay, so it starts with capability.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care where you build, it starts with the development of the capability in the vehicle. And every Jeep we do starts that way. So we need to be best in class in the segment we're in. On this particular Jeep, We actually really set it up for, we redesigned the whole front engine box for the structure we needed. We reset up the whole suspension, put a whole rear Chapman system in, allowed us to get about 8 inches of spring travel front rear. Mm. We developed really an all new drive system, so the new 4x4 system for this size. You know, similar to what we did on the Jeep Cherokee, basically fully decoupled system that it gives us full flexibility. So when you're driving along, it's driving in a very efficient mode, but when you need the capability, it turns right on. This particular model, which is a Trailhawk, as you take a look, I mean, the front approach angle, 30 degrees, best in class. Rear departure angle, 34, breakover, 24. You see the off-road tires. You combine that with all the skid plate packages. And then we brought in our Select Train system, the same that we launched on Grand Cherokee, into Renegade. That allows us to really adjust all those capabilities. And we test it as a Jeep. Matter of fact, yesterday I was over at Silver Lake testing the sands because we're dialing the final sand modes on the vehicle. I mean, it's a developed Jeep full by full. It doesn't matter where you attach a component and where you weld a part in the world. It has to perform as a Jeep, and this Jeep will, and the market is going after. And that's how we set it up.
Phil, does your research show that other markets are as will want the Trailhawk as much as the American or the North American market will? Are they as concerned about the off-road capabilities? Are there parts of the world where more so than less? Obviously, maybe the Middle East versus, say, Europe or, South America.
Yeah, so as we're designing across 100 countries, there's a few things we dial in. First will be our engine choices. Okay, so in North America, we offer four-cylinder gas engines, diesels in Europe, well, we combine different transmissions in China. Okay, so we combine it. But in terms of that, we have basically a front-wheel drive model that a certain percentage of the market has with a different, you know, altitude of the vehicle. We then do a 4x4 model and then a Trailhawk model. The Trailhawk is always our most capable model of any Jeep, whether that be 10% in a segment or 20% in a particular market, it'll vary. Typically in this, for Jeeps, we have a fairly high all-wheel drive 4x4 mix, anywhere from 70 to 80% in most of the, many of the markets we're in. In Europe, it could be a little lower. In China, it could be a little lower. But we offer the capability in each market to do that.
What's your get about Europe? Do you think maybe because of fuel prices and so on, they might go with the less off-road capable trim levels and maybe a little bit higher take rate?
There's a tendency to have a little more less all-wheel drive 4x4 versions.
Yeah.
But here's what we did, and this is, you know, part of Jeep's, if you think about historically, Jeep's challenge, always capable. And when it comes to sort of that fuel efficiency or that on-road behavior, you know, historically that wasn't our strength. That's what we've been working on all the last generations. So let's talk fuel efficiency. When you have a 4x4 system, you have a lot of moving parts that turn up a lot of friction. And obviously that friction burns fuel. So what we brought in here is if you think about the front half shafts and the rear shafts, they always got to spin. But in a normal 4x4, so does your basically your power transfer unit, your drive shaft, and your rear RDM. Those are always in motion, your 4x4. So what we tend to do is on our 4x4 models, we turn all those off. Essentially, we just basically have it acting in front-wheel drive. As soon as it detects any slip, It starts to spin up basically the rear RDM, gets the prop shaft moving, engages the front when you need it. You can always lock it on. So our goal from is whether you're driving a 4x4 or a front-wheel drive model, you're getting fuel efficiency that's very similar. I mean, it used to be 3-4 miles per gallon as we used to know. I mean, now it's almost one, and sometimes it's a percentage of 1 mile per gallon.
So basically what you're saying is that if we have the 4x4 system and we're driving along the highway in dry open road, it'd be biased toward the front drive.
All advantage, you're getting basically
100% front.
It's accurate, all front wheel drive unless you locked on 4x4.
And then it detects wheel slip?
Essentially turns the system on, automatically turns it on to basically its 4x4 mode as it needs it. And then it can turn it back off.
Same system in the Cherokee, right?
It's the same concept.
Concept, okay.
Different hardware because we sized the hardware for the size of the vehicle, but very similar in terms of the methodology.
It's the American Axle system, is it?
It's not the same. It's not the same supplier.
Oh, interesting. Who, can you say who the supplier is?
I'd prefer not.
Okay.
I mean, I know. Of course,
we're not going to beat you up on it yet.
but essentially, it's a similar concept. Different devices in terms of the motor or the clutch activation, but similar concept in how we set it up. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is other vehicles won't do that because if our vehicles do an all-wheel drive, they'll just make it full-time, and you'll lose a little bit of that friction, that fuel economy. So we wanted to make sure that all our Jeeps, because we want our Jeeps to always be capable out there in a lot of segments to be a fairly high 4x4 mix, we offer that technology.
And so that lock for the four-wheel drive, that comes with any four-wheel drive system, not just the Trailhawk system.
You can always lock in your four-wheel drive system at any given time on all four-wheel drives. On the Trailhawk, we have a little bit different combination of things we offer because essentially we offer rock mode and we have some different setup of the vehicle in terms of what it can do. And we then also our active dry low system. So we have a normal 4x4 is our active drive one, and then for our Trailhawk, it's our active drive low.
You mentioned Klaus Busse, and he's in charge of interior design for Chrysler Group or whatever it's called now. So what is done on these? We got to talk about the interior a little bit. Give those guys their due. What's in the Renegade interior that makes it Jeep?
Well, I won't be able to use at all the adjectives and the explanations that Klaus could give.
Okay? Sure.
But if you look at the vehicle, it's a much more youthful expression. He had a very young design team work on the vehicle to try to break away from some of the paradigms.
And here you can see on the screen, Chip's got the camera.
And you'll basically see some of the different color expressions, some of the formations. And again, as an engineer, I can't give you the right expressions for what it all is. Mm-hmm. But as you look at the vehicle and its expressions, is definitely much more going for the younger customer. Mm-hmm. And he had a very young design team working on it. And our goal was to execute what he came up with, basically.
Okay. Just call it orange accents, Phil. I'm sure he'd have a fancier word for it.
You're talking about fuel economy. Chrysler's doing some interesting stuff in the U.S. market. There's a diesel in the Grand Cherokee. Mm-hmm. There's a diesel in the Ram. Consumer Reports just gave great accolades to the diesel in the Grand Cherokee. I think you're going to have a diesel for the European market. Is that right?
We're going to have two diesels for the European market.
Two?
A 1.6 and a 2-liter diesel, basically matched up with basically 6-speed manuals and 9-speed automatics.
So if the sales of the diesel Ram and Grand Cherokee really start to get into some serious numbers, how about with this Renegade?
I'll never say never, because one time I was quoted saying never on Grand Cherokee. Diesel can the vehicle do it? The answer is yes. Does the economics work in this type of segment with diesel engines? That's always a constant thing we look at.
Far more price sensitive here than on a 30 to 40 or more $1,000 Grand Cherokee.
The challenge, and you know, as you bring diesels into this market with the emissions and the treatments you have to put on them and the cost of those after treatments in the vehicle, the economic equation is different than it is over in Europe.
But it's as they say, protected for...
The vehicle has five engines. Okay, I mentioned the two.
Wow.
Okay, essentially the
now, there's a lot of calibration work.
And basically, along with a 1.6 e-torque, so it's five engines. It, on transmission, has a 5-speed manual, a 6-speed manual, a 9-speed automatic, and a DDCT that we'll use over in Asia. Okay, we matched it up with 4x4 and 4x2, so there's really 16 different combinations globally.
Wow.
In North America, we're going to focus on two engines with a 6-speed manual and a 9-speed automatic. But in each market, you have to apply differently. And also, as you get into Latin America, you get into different versions of calibration for the ethanol.
Which version gets the 6-speed manual as an option? Is that narrow?
In North America, it'll basically be the 1.4 turbo fire. Mm-hmm. You'll get the 6-speed manual. Once you get up into the 2.4, mm-hmm. it'll basically match up with the 9-speed.
And which engines does the Trailhawk get? Are both
Trailhawk
those in?
Only gets the 2.4 9-speed.
Only the 2.4. Okay.
Because for the Trailhawk, you need the extra, basically, horsepower balance, what sure. you need for the vehicle for its off-road work. So we lock in with that, and we lock it only in with the 9-speed so we can get the torque leverage of the first gear and how we match up with the active drive low system.
Got it.
Hey, we're getting a lot of questions, good questions coming in from the audience. I think we ought to get to the rapid fire part of the okay. show. And so, Ben, let it rip. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. Actually, just as we're coming out of this little break for the rapid fire, Chip's got the camera here, and he was asking about the Easter eggs. As Chrysler's really famous now for hiding little design icons in its vehicles, and can you tell us about any of the Easter eggs here?
There are a lot of Easter eggs on this vehicle, more than I think I know where they're all at.
Look where Chip's looking right now, because I think he done found one of
them. Yeah, really all through the exterior and the interior, there's numerous examples. I think you should look at one on the up of the mirror cover. The funny story of Easter eggs.
So this is the cover for the inside rear view mirror. It has a little Jeep icon front end on it.
Has the Willys Jeep front end. We leverage that in numerous locations. You'll see it on the trim. You'll see it on the lighting.
Oh, what are we looking at here?
Well, that's just basically a bezel along the speaker or the door trim. You can see the same Jeep expression. I'm not sure I know where they're all at. And
probably only Klaus does, right?
Klaus or, and Mark Allen.
And Mark, right.
Then you'll see even on the wheel, there's a Willys Jeep on the Renegade wheel.
Oh, nice.
That's cool.
At first I saw it, I thought maybe there was a tape on the wheel, and I went down there, that's a Jeep.
You have to wash it yourself to find that.
Yeah, that's right. That's cool stuff. Is that enough for now, Chip?
Yeah,
I think that's okay, good.
There are plenty more, believe me. The first one was done about 5 years ago, and I didn't know Mark was doing it. I didn't realize it until it popped up at the assembly plant. And all of a sudden, I thought it was a defect, and I realized it's a Willys Jeep face on the light shield. So lots of cleverness by their design team.
You should have a contest.
Kudos to them. I think it's awesome what they're doing. Okay, let's get to some of the questions. Dr. Botox wrote in to say, are the Jeep folks, and you're one of them, tired of seeing the Range Rover, the Audi Q7, the Mercedes GL, Lexus RX, and Cadillac Escalade mint money in a segment pioneered and abandoned by the Grand Wagoneer?
Well, let's just say the Grand Wagoneer was a very historical vehicle for the brand. And it has a name that a lot of people remember, okay?
And in Sergio's most recent presentation, it sure looked like there's a Grand Wagoneer.
Look at the five-year plan. It's in there someplace.
Yeah.
Plus, you're not doing too poorly with the margins on the Grand Cherokee these days.
Grand Cherokee's been a very successful product for us, and yes, Sergio presents the five-year plan, and we work to Sergio's plan as we do.
That's right. Okay, Aaron wants to know, why isn't the Renegade offering the 1.4 turbo engine with the 9-speed in the U.S. when it's offered in the EU?
From just matching up with the 9-speed, and we kind of, the majority of what we want to do in the U.S., because really when you match it up with the 1.4 turbo, I mean, it's a lot of technology. I mean, it's a turbo technology matched up with a 9-speed. And what we found is for a lot of our off-road work, we wanted to match everything up with the 2.4. So for the higher amount of you mentioned earlier about the 4x4 mix in the United States versus yep. maybe in Europe, that's why we matched it up really with the 2.4 here.
S10.
It could have been done, but we chose to really limit the one engine with the 9-speed.
S10 Baja says, I know this is a Jeep show, but rumors on the net say GMC is going to have its own model that does not share any underpinnings with Chevy. Another rumor hints at a Jeep Wrangler competitor. Any truth? And I guess we don't. Or you keep pretty close tabs on the competition, I'll bet.
I'm sure there's always lots of rumors going around.
You guys hear anything about it?
I hadn't heard that, but I mean, don't forget that GM used to own Hummer, and they're no longer around to copy your grill, of course.
They probably have the
that cursed
they
have, them, right?
They have the tooling somewhere.
But yeah. I mean, I remember seeing some. The drawings that they showed to the press a few years ago, drawings or images of vehicles like that, so I wouldn't be surprised.
Doctor,
that were Hummers now could be GMCs.
That's right. This isn't a question for you, Phil, but Dr. Potox also says, when does Mary Barra fire the people responsible for the Cadillac ELR? It's being outsold by the Dodge Viper. Kudos for the Viper,
yeah,
I guess.
Kudos for the Viper. It needs it. Well, maybe they don't want to sell so many. Maybe it's like what Sergio Marchionne said about the Fiat 500e Fiat 500e. Don't buy it. It costs me $14,000 every time you do.
That's right. Hey, Ben, I see we've got a phone call in here about the Renegade. Let's bring that phone call in.
Hi, this is Frank Reed from Bridgeton, New Jersey. And my question about the Jeep is, why build it in Italy and then ship it all the way to the United States? I'm sure there's probably all kinds of tariffs and the like. Wouldn't it be cheaper to simply either build it in the U.S. for the U.S. market or build it in Mexico for the North American market? Or do you really think it's not, its biggest market is not going to be North America but outside of the country? Thanks, John. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thanks for the question. Good question.
Industrialization decisions of where we put our products globally around the world are obviously well thought out and balanced with other products. And so not every assembly plant is available for every product in every region of the world. And that's the balancing that our executive team does. So obviously the exchange rate between here and the euro is a little bit different than, you know, today than it maybe was a few years ago. But overall, we're building Jeeps in every segment, and sometimes we'll build Jeeps here to send to Europe, and sometimes we'll build them there to send to North America. So right now we build them in Detroit, that we send them around the globe. We build them in Toledo, and we send them around the globe. You have to make decisions product by product. And
well, I think another thing, too, is it's now Fiat Chrysler. It's no longer just Chrysler. Fiat has a lot of empty capacity in Italy. And I know some, or at least what Sergio said in the Bataan Death March of a press conference that we were recently at, was that the decision was made, look, we're going to fill unused capacity rather than put new capacity in elsewhere. So I think that's another reason.
It's part of the overall business case is you bring in new products.
Sure. And look, you know, that will improve the health of the overall company, too. So
it also provides a little bit of you know, hedging both ways, too, you know, from an overall exchange and currency and that type
sure.
of thing. But
And to go back to the aforementioned Honda, I mean, their policy was always build them where you sell them. And if you have a great market in Europe for vehicles of this size, this category, build them there. Makes more sense.
And if demand really takes off, as you said earlier, never say never.
Say never in this business.
Let's see. D. Britton says, I always hear, this is, I guess, just more generic for anybody. He says, I hear about the cost difference between a ton of steel versus a ton of aluminum. What's the difference in weight of a cubic foot of each? So I see where he's going on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's a cubic foot of steel weigh versus a cubic foot of aluminum?
Isn't it like a third of the density?
Yeah, I can't give exact figures.
But I mean, approximately a third.
Yeah.
So
that sounds right to me. I think.
So
discuss that once.
So no matter how you scaled it, it would still be a third.
Yeah.
I guess he's just trying to get an idea. Is, you know, he sees a coil and that's a ton of steel,
right?
And it's, and then there's a coil and it's a ton of aluminum.
The idea is that a ton of aluminum will build more car than a ton of steel will.
Yeah, no, yes, it will. Absolutely right. Maybe
30%
more. If Gary's right, that's exactly right. Let's see. JM1NB wants to know, regarding the GM investigation, have any supplier employees been identified? I don't believe so.
No. I mean, Delphi was, I think, identified as a supplier, and There's something about Continental today.
One company did ignition switches for one of the models, and the other company did ignition switches for the other model.
And they were to the same spec?
Sort of. And even Eaton was involved because apparently they were the ones who started this thing, and then they were bought by Delphi and so on. So, yeah, they did talk to suppliers, and suppliers are named.
Suppliers are named, but not employees of those suppliers.
If any heads have rolled as a
could
result,
be in the footnotes.
Yeah, not that we know of.
Yeah.
At this show, at least.
They have tiny little footnotes here.
Yeah.
So that every page has those tiny little footnotes. Yeah. But,
okay. Course. Back to our Jeep guy. Wright Knight wants to know, why does Jeep not do a full-framed rear-drive Mini Wrangler? Rear-drive-based Mini Wrangler. Then Ram could do a truly compact truck off the same platform.
Over the years, we've pretty much have studied everything. Just different combinations. Obviously, Wranglers are only frame Jeep currently, okay? And our trucks are still frame constructions. We've looked at that, but, you know, again, right now where the world's going in terms of fuel economy, where it's going in terms of efficiency requirements, in terms of weight, in terms of all the stuff that we got to do, we got to apply that to all our Jeeps. So, yes, you could do it, but what does that require us to do with the rest of the fleet? So, I mean, that's not just here. That's in every market around the world. So Jeeps are pushing real hard on fuel economy, and we're going to find the most weight-efficient way to deliver the capability, the performance, and the fuel economy of those vehicles.
And clearly, Phil, you're not seeing any advantage in terms of its off-road capabilities if it's the traditional body-on-frame or traditional rear drive.
It was actually interesting because a lot of people don't realize the original Cherokee was unibody, uniframe. The original Grand Cherokee was unibody. If you design for the capability, you can get all the stiffness properties, but you got to start with that. I mean, you can't beat a live axle on a framed Wrangler in terms of its Rubicon capability. Fully agree with there. Mm-hmm. But as you look across your entire fleet of vehicles and where you want to be, we've actually said back when most vehicles were body on frame, Jeep was already at unibody in this segment.
That's exactly right. Here's a good one to throw to you. RMT1 says, what are your thoughts of the Ford Troller SUV developed for Brazil? I don't know much about that at all.
I don't know much about it, truthfully, either.
Okay.
Okay.
But Troller, I think, was like this little Brazilian specialty company, was it? Do I have that right? Do you guys know this?
I just saw the picture they released earlier this week, and I think it was when we were in Santa Barbara, so I didn't pay much attention.
It's at the moment a regional lower volume concept, and I mean, I don't know the specs of it. It's off-road capability. It's performance in general.
Yeah, Ford's doing some interesting things, you know, little sideline stuff that I don't know much. You know, they're into full-size, heavy-duty trucks in China. They bought some company there. I'm almost wondering, is Ford going to get back into the heavy truck market again? But, yeah, and then they got this little Troller thing out of Brazil. I don't know much about it.
What happens to one Ford?
Well, maybe it's going to be one Ford with big trucks,
yeah,
too.
And part of that has to do with what they have to do in China to meet the local China trade laws if they want to grow to a certain size. Mm-hmm. I saw that truck in Beijing, and they showed a big body-on-frame sports utility that looked like it could be the design for a future Explorer, except it's a body on frame.
Oh, yeah, and off their Ranger truck, their international Ranger truck.
Right.
Yeah, that's common. That there's no doubt that one's coming.
Not to the U.S., though. Not as a body on frame.
Right, to the world, though.
Right, right.
Okay, we'll make this the last question, and I think that I'm going to throw this more to Todd and Gary. Joe in San Antonio says, John, have you been keeping up with Acura's delays in delivering the new TLX? At the New York show, they promised an early summer delivery. Now it's been pushed to late summer for some unexplained reason. We're trying to get an absolutely perfect reason. Appears to me the timing of the delay coincides with the management changes at Acura. Can appreciate trying to get it right, but absolutely perfect? And what about the perennial delays of the NSX, the RLX hybrid? All very puzzling. What is going on with Acura?
Oh, boy. Well, I know that they delayed the first drives of the right. TLX, and I think they're now talking. Do you remember what date they've now set for it, which they claim they will stick with? And NSX, is that really off schedule?
I don't think it's off schedule.
I think it's they're still looking. We'll see a production version probably at Detroit early next year, and it was always scheduled to go on sale next year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, good question, Joe. Thanks for bringing this to our attention. You got our interest peaked up. I said that was going to be the last question. I lied. There's one more for you here. Go faster. Phil wants to know, moving SRT under Dodge, what's that mean for any Jeep SRTs?
It's an open discussion, but I can't get any further discussion with that.
Fair enough. Well, look, this has been terrific having you come in here. I have not been able to drive this vehicle yet. I'm dying to drive it. I think it's going to be really cool. I think you guys are going to do very well with this. I can't believe how well. Gary, you know the sales. Aren't they up like 50% or something?
49%.
Yeah.
Jeep.
Yeah.
Overall
in fact, I think the Wrangler damn near outsold the entire Chrysler brand last month.
Yeah, while the Dodge Dart has had kind of a slow increase in sales, the Wrangler hit 10,000 a month very quickly. And then on top of that, you've got consistently 12, 13, 14,000 a month for the nicely margined Grand Cherokee. And for the Wrangler, which probably also does pretty well for you.
No, last month they did 18,000 Wrangler. So
18,000. Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of earlier.
The brand's on fire, man. It's unreal. Yeah. It's strong up and down the line.
Yeah, and this month it's 58% increase over last year. And to your point, all of Chrysler did 22,592 for the month of May.
So 22,000 Chrysler brand, 19,000 just the Wrangler, yeah. Or 18,000.
Wrangler was 19,000.
19,000. So 19,000 Wranglers.
19,000 Wranglers and 18,000 Grand Cherokees. 16,000 Cherokees.
Yeah, sounds like they can afford to do even more Easter eggs.
No, I hope for your sake they've got a good bonus plan over at Chrysler.
Well, I thought Jeep is exciting because for many years we did not leverage the brand and who we were globally. And we're getting great support by the entire global management team and the resources being put in place.
Oh, the upside potential is so big.
But we're being very careful. When we bring that vehicle out, it will be the most capable in its segment. And we will go after also fuel efficiency and the on-road experience. But we got to hit that, what Jeep is, because we got to stay core to our brand. And that's who we are. And that's what the team is. And the team will be a very global team. It'll be focused that way. And hopefully you get a chance to drive it.
I will.
Probably, I think, the fall time, I think, is when maybe we'll have our drive here in North America.
Cool. Phil Jansen, thanks so much for coming on After Hours. Great to have you here. Awesome to have the Jeep Renegade in the studio.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Todd, always having good having you here. Good to see you.
Good having you.
Yeah, I haven't had too much of you this week. Maybe Gary has, but it's great that you're here on the show.
I could understand if you did.
And Gary, great having you here as always. So.
Good seeing you. Do it again next week.
We will do that. So all of you out there, come on back next week. We will be here.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.